From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Devin Nunes announced today that he's temporarily stepping aside as leader of the committee's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election, though he will remain chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. Democrats have been calling for Nunes to recuse himself for the past 2 weeks, saying he's too close to the White House and not able to run an impartial investigation. Scott Detrow is NPR congressional reporter. He joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Jeremy.
And this is pretty big news. I mean, it didn't seem like Nunes had any intention of stepping aside from this investigation. Why is he doing it now?
Yeah, this was really surprising because he's been consistently pressured to do this ever since that episode where he came forward with information that he said came from a whistleblower and, in fact, likely came from White House staffers themselves about this whole masking thing, which I guess if we spell that all out, that's another 20 minutes because that story has taken so many twists and turns. But the bottom line is that Democrats had said that Nunes seemed more interested in supporting the Trump White House than investigating the Trump White House, and he had resisted those calls. So it was very surprising to see until a few minutes later, a statement came out from the House Ethics Committee saying that they have launched an initial review of whether in all of these statements Nunes had made unauthorized disclosures of classified information.
Now, we said that he is temporarily stepping aside. What does that mean? Is there a chance he's going to come back and run the investigation again?
I think he's leaving that open. I think just politically and logistically, it would be very hard for him to retake control of the investigation after he once stepped away, especially since after so many Democrats on the committee said that he had just lost their trust to conduct a bipartisan investigation. The key point is that he's remaining chair of the committee. So on other things the committee does, Nunes is still in charge. But of course, this is the most high profile thing the committee's doing right
now.
Who's
taking his place?
A Texas Republican, Mike Conaway, is taking his place. And House Speaker Paul Ryan issued a statement saying that Nunes still has his trust. But we actually just got a really interesting statement from Nancy Pelosi. I'll just read one sentence of it. She said, "The White House made a fool of Chairman Nunes, and he has deeply tarnished his credibility as chairman."
Well, and also we hear that another person that's going to be helping out in the investigation is going to be Trey Gowdy, who
that's
we all know from the Benghazi investigation.
That's right. Gowdy is a member of the committee. He's one of several Republicans who spent the bulk of question time during that public hearing a few weeks ago, you know, focusing almost exclusively on who's leaking information and not the bigger questions of what Russia was doing and whether there was any coordination or conversation with members of either campaign or the Trump campaign.
Okay, so lots to watch in the House, but it is also a big day today in the Senate. Senate Democrats filibustered Judge Neil Gorsuch's nomination to the Supreme Court. The initial vote was 55-4, 45 against, with four Democrats voting in favor of Gorsuch. So that means Republicans are going to now trigger the so-called nuclear option to be able to confirm Gorsuch with a simple majority, just 51 votes instead of 60. How close are they to actually officially making that rules change?
This is a very, you know, if you like rules of order and parliamentary procedure, this is your time to shine right now. It's a series of parliamentary points. Mitch McConnell is making them. Chuck Schumer is making them. It's going to go on for a while. But the end result of all of this parliamentary procedure is a rules change that's going to fundamentally shift the way that the Senate does business.
What's the atmosphere like in the Senate today?
You know, this is really telling. I was in the Senate for a while during that first cloture vote, and it is notable that the Senate is actually full today. Most of the senators are sitting at their desks. The press gallery is packed. The observers gallery is packed. That's hardly ever the case anymore. You know, you have three or four senators in the chamber at a time. But this shows how monumental it is. It's kind of like the old Senate before C-SPAN. Everyone is there and clearly paying close attention.
But do they feel just bad and upset about the fact that this is happening, that they're changing the rules in this fundamental way?
Yeah, there is a bipartisan consensus that what's happening right now is bad for the Senate in general, will lead to more partisan, more ideological Supreme Court justices, you know, an erosion of trust of the Supreme Court. But, you know, the skeptical view of this is you have all these senators saying this is a really terrible decision to make, and no Democrat or no Republican is making an effort to reverse course here and try and reach a conclusion that isn't the one that they're all upset about. It seems almost everyone's treating it as inevitable result of just years of partisan gridlock when it comes to the judiciary.
And just briefly, the vote to confirm Gorsuch would be tomorrow, correct?
The final vote to put him on the court will be tomorrow after the new cloture vote under the new rules that will happen at some point this afternoon.
That's NPR congressional reporter Scott Detrow joining us from Washington. Lots going on there today. Scott, thank you.
Sure thing.
Well, Chinese President Xi Jinping kicks off a two-day visit with President Trump later today. The first meeting between the two will be held at the president's Florida resort, Mar-a-Lago. Much to talk about, from North Korean missiles to President Trump's threat to impose a huge tariff on Chinese goods because of what he sees as a trade imbalance. China is also the largest source of foreign students at U.S. universities. There are more than 300,000 across the country. And over the next couple days, we'll check in with a couple to talk about everything from cell phones to human rights abuses. Let's start with Simeo Lee, studying economics at Yale in Connecticut. Simeo, what would you like to hear the two presidents talk about?
Well, as an economics student, apparently I'm more concerned with how the negotiation goes with regard to trade. Mm-hmm. But also I think another issue that would definitely be discussed is North Korea, since they have launched a missile just yesterday, right before the meeting, which is unfortunate timing. And I'm looking forward to see how the two presidents negotiate around these two issues and what kind of compromises will be made separately.
Well, as you know, President Trump told the Financial Times, China has to help us with North Korea, and if China doesn't, the U.S. will take unilateral action. Do you think your country can do more? It has more of a relationship with North Korea. You're certainly closer. Do you think your country can or should be doing more to talk North Korea down from its weapons program?
Well, I mean, China definitely can do more, since China could very easily put economic sanctions. And North Korea relies really heavily on China in terms of export. But the question really is, does China want to do more? And I don't think China really does want to do more, because like the North Korea issue has always been a little bit sensitive for China. But I think probably something that will come out of the negotiation is I would expect some rhetoric to sort of counter the North Korea actions. I won't expect anything substantial.
But you'd like to see even some language. Well, that's interesting. And you mentioned trade. What would you like to see with trade?
Well, I mean, again, I don't think a lot of what President Trump has been campaigning on are going to come true just because it's mutually not beneficial. But I think one thing that might be beneficial for the United States and the Chinese would like to get on board might be just enforcing the currently existing international trade rules a little bit more aggressively. For instance, I think something that President Xi might want to compromise on would be strengthening protect for international property and strengthening rules against anti-dumping. And those are the things that President Trump really wants to pursue, and that would directly corresponds to his constituents as well.
So you agree that you know, the Chinese have been accused of stealing intellectual property, patents and such.
Yeah.
You're saying that that's something that China should address. Anti-dumping, elaborate on that.
Well, China has apparently exports a lot of steels, like cheap steels, to the United States, which has added to a lot of agonies of the U.S. workers, especially in the Rust Belt, I would say. So I think that's a point where Trump would really want to get in and earn a little bit of something for his voters.
So that's so interesting. You agree that China is dumping cheap steel on the U.S. Of course, construction people here say it works to their advantage, you know, because it is so cheap. But as you noted, it's putting steel workers here out of jobs. So you're saying that is something that China could compromise on. What could the U.S. compromise on?
Well, I mean, U.S. could, like Trump, firstly could rein in a little bit on his rhetoric against China. And apparently, he has already reversed course on the question of Taiwan, which is a good sign. Also, China would probably expect Trump to compromise a little bit on North Korea instead of just saying, oh, we're going to go right in and pursue unilateral military action, because that's something China doesn't want to see.
Well, and again, President Trump has not said he'd take military action, but he has said he would, you know, take
right.
care of North Korea. So, but I hear
yeah.
you. Do the relations, when they got particularly heated between the Trump campaign and China, you know, Donald mm-hmm. Trump saying that China was raping our country with some of its trade imbalance, does that worry you? I hear you laughing. Or do you think that that's just talk?
Well, I mean, that's apparently just talk. And I seriously don't really understand why Trump is so insistent on focusing on the trade deficits, because mm-hmm. the United States has trade deficits with another 110 or 111 countries in the world. I mean, the point really is, how does Trump domestically try to distribute this kind of surplus from trade more equally so that some of the voters who voted for him can benefit as well. That's when I think Trump could potentially target some of the key issues that his constituents care about. Now, instead of just labeling China currency manipulator, it doesn't do any good, because China's currency has been appreciating for so long now that it's really ridiculous to, for this moment, say that China has been manipulating its currency.
You're saying that Donald Trump should just try to figure out ways to compromise with the Chinese to make it better for the people who voted for him, the people who are in manufacturing and other industries.
Right.
Simeo Li, undergraduate economics student at Yale, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The final episode of the sixth season of Homeland airs on Showtime this Sunday. The show focuses on the ongoing fight against terrorism, largely through the actions of Carrie Mathison, a now ex-CIA agent played by Claire Danes. Mandy Patinkin plays the character of Saul Berenson, Carrie's mentor. Here's a scene from season four with both of them, where Saul has been captured and is supposed to be exchanged for five terrorists.
Saul.
What?
I promised Mira I was bringing you home.
You think I want to go home? You said this wouldn't happen. You promised me no exchange.
Couldn't let you die.
It wasn't up to you. It wasn't your call. You think I can live with this? I can't even look at it.
Mandy Patinkin joins us now from New York. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And I want to start with Homeland. And one of the things about Homeland all along the way over the many seasons is that it has managed to stay kind of close to what's going on in real life. And we see that again in this season. In one of the most recent episodes, we see people protesting, chanting, "Not my president." You hear the word deplorable. And there's a storyline involving the dark web and fake social media accounts. Is this something, did you get lucky on some of these, or is this really just trying to keep it close to the news?
Well, the sock puppets and bots in terms of the dark web was already on the slate to happen. Certainly the writers went back to the drawing board when the election happened. Everyone was expecting a female president, but the fake news and also the Russian intervention into the election, which is on everyone's front page, that fit our storyline perfectly. So the writers began improvising, and I feel that without any disparaging to any of the brilliant actors that we have in our company or writers or anything, that the two most interesting characters of the season for me have become fake news and the truth.
And is part of the goal there to just be part of the conversation, of the national conversation, aside from just being entertainment?
Well, you're right in saying that it is, I guess, entertainment, but I don't know if it's first and foremost entertainment anymore. I get more calls from people recently that this is their favorite season of the six seasons we've completed because they feel that it isn't poetic version of the world we're living in, but it is literally, frighteningly, desperately truthful to the moment that we're living in. And that is because our writers have been writing it as we went along, literally that day, that hour, that moment, sometimes in the middle of shooting a scene.
Well, I read an article that you, a couple of years ago in a previous season, actually broke down in tears when you found out what the writers had done in a certain episode. Do you get hooked on the story the way that we, the viewers, do?
I do indeed. I ask them not to tell me what's happening unless I absolutely need to know, just as we don't know what's happening in our own lives. 1 second from now, none of us know. That leaves quite a bit of hope and optimism available. That is how I get through this day, this world that we're living in, and how Saul Berenson functions. He is a profoundly hopeful, optimistic individual.
Have you been disappointed by any of the plot turns that have been put into the show?
No, I haven't been, because this system of false information and truth that has seemed to take over the focus of the show is so, horrifyingly important to bear witness to. Mm-hmm. I have to say that it mirrors the world around us so accurately that what I do when the season is over, and you have to understand, I'm living in a fictional hell. That is the job of Saul Berenson. And I'm not complaining about it. I'm not like going, oh, boo-hoo, poor guy. He's in a TV series that has to be in a fictional hell. The real world is far more hellish for all of us than any fictional representation of it. But where I go and where I've gone the past 2 years, literally the day after I've wrapped each season, is I fly immediately to the refugee crisis in Lesbos, Greece. And when you play with false information, when you don't honor the truth and facts, it is affecting people's lives deeply and desperately. When we meet these families, if you go to Greece and Serbia and the Croatian border and you meet these beautiful children and families and extraordinary human beings who've been through such hell, bombs coming through their living rooms, blowing small children into the other room, taking the whole family in the middle of the night to the Turkish border over mountains where the children have snow up to their necks, spending 2 years trying to get through a vetting process. And then what happens in this country? Since 1975, 3 million Americans have been resettled as refugees in America. Since 9/11, 900,000. And in that time, not a single terrorist incident has taken place by a refugee. So these citizens who are truly what make America great, this is the fabric of our country, our nation, our families, my ancestors, I wouldn't be talking to you if the United States of America didn't open its welcome arms to my grandparents. These are the safest citizens in our country. I beg everyone to pay attention to those truths.
So I now have to ask you, after hearing that, about one piece of criticism that I've heard of Homeland, and I'm sure you've heard it as well. There was an opinion piece in the Washington Post a few years back that said, since its first episode, Homeland has churned out Islamophobic stereotypes as if its writers were getting paid by the cliche. Is that criticism something that you guys have talked about on the set, or do you feel that that's not fair?
No, it was very fair. As a matter of fact, there's a very famous incident when we were filming in Berlin, and they had put up graffiti that was in Arabic, and it called Homeland racist, and Homeland was watermelon, and it got by, and it went on the air. Our writers didn't expect, nor did us as players, expect that to be a criticism. Yet it's a fair criticism. We absolutely became part of the problem of the Islamophobia. It became very painful to the writers and to all of us, and a tremendous amount of attention has been paid to trying to be part of the cure instead of part of the problem anymore. And this season has been a tremendously successful effort in that vein. Our lead character, played by Claire Danes, Carrie Matheson, had a job in an office that was taking care of human rights for Muslim victims of false accusations. And as you follow through the season, you come to learn that the guilty ones are not, certainly not the Muslim community, certainly not the refugees or the immigrants that have come here, but the white male membership of even members of the intelligence community and other parts of our government.
So in addition to Homeland, you're also going to be Papa Smurf this Friday in the Smurfs movie, Smurfs the Lost Village. That must be a pretty different experience.
Yeah, that was a great segue. yes, I am Papa Smurf, and it was such a joy, so much fun to be a part of it. I never had more fun in front of a microphone in my life, and it's a beautiful family movie. I've asked Sony to please, as soon as possible, to get it translated into Arabic, because I want the children in these refugee resettlement communities to be able to watch it and enjoy the journey of these little creatures who are racing through the forest trying to survive their adventure as well.
Well, Mandy Patinkin, while we have you, before we let you go, I have to play you a clip that I'm sure you've heard a million times, but we'll play it for our audience too in case they didn't know this was you.
Hello! My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die!
Okay, so obviously from The Princess Bride, which came out, by the way, 30 years ago this year. How important was that role in creating the career that you're living right now?
Well, it actually didn't do very well when it first came out, the movie. It became a college cult film, and then those kids had kids, and their kids had kids, and that's how it's become the movie of this moment. It's been a joy. I can't believe when anybody plays me a clip or comes up to me and says, "Are you the guy? Would you say the line for me?" And it thrills me to no end. It's fascinating, though, how it creeps into every aspect of our life. Ted Cruz, when he was running for president, was a huge Princess Bride fan.
Right.
He would quote the lines and, you know, trying to win families and everything. And the New York Times called me up one day and said, "Are you aware of this, that he's quoting all of you and using your movie to essentially become elected president?" And I was very well aware of it. And I made a plea to Senator Cruz to consider what I consider the most brilliant line that William Goldman wrote for the movie. Inigo standing at the doorway after the princess has jumped into the arms of Andre the Giant, Fezzik, and the man in black has offered him a job. And Inigo says, "You know, I have been in the revenge business so long. Now that it's over, I do not know what to do with the rest of my life."
Hmm.
And with Mr. Cruz and others suggesting carpet bombing all kinds of individuals in different places of the world, I asked them to consider other options than revenge. Hmm. Because when we resort to that, as opposed to finding ways to live together with our uncomfortablenesses, the discomfort that we have, whether it's the way you pray or eat, or we have differences and we can learn to live with those differences. And when even nation states try to fix those differences by killing our fellow human beings, then we lose everything. And so I think William Goldman gave us a great lesson of asking us to consider what to do after revenge is no longer an option.
Are you going to run for office?
I'm an actor and a performer, and I have my hands full. But I tell you, it is one of the great privileges, if not the singular greatest privilege, of having any platform whatsoever that being in the entertainment business gives so many, is to be able to be the voice for those who are so vulnerable all over the world, who are, as the refugees just for one area, are trapped in limbo. And I encourage people to listen to their voices.
That's Mandy Patinkin, the actor who currently plays Saul Berenson on Showtime's Homeland, which is about to finish its sixth season. And he also appears as the voice of Papa Smurf in Smurfs: The Lost Village, which is in theaters Friday. Mandy Patinkin, thank you so much. Great to have you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Knowing that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You don't have to spend time at the grocery store. Make great meals in under 40 minutes. There's no commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
March Madness has come and gone. Sorry, Zags. Way to go, Heels. But other seasons are starting and ending. The Masters, the first major golf tournament of the year, teed off today in Augusta, Georgia. Next week, the playoffs start in the NBA and the NHL. And this week saw opening days in Major League Baseball. So let's talk about that with Mike Pesca, here now's sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
So last year, this little thing happened where the Cubs just shredded the headlines when they won their first World Series since 1908. Some are saying this might be an even better season for them. What do you think?
Well, they're a great team, and a lot of their players were young, especially their position players, so you could project some growth. Offensively, they could very well be better. They lost Dexter Fowler and a couple other players. Here's the thing and the problem, and it's not much of a problem. The Cubs are an excellent team. They've got a great manager, and they play in a rather weak division. But last year, their pitchers were all healthy. I think their five starters, you know, missed just a handful of starts among them, and that never happens. And winning in baseball is about a lot of things, but these days, it's pretty much become, success in baseball is just a proxy for if your pitchers don't get hurt.
Hmm.
So since the Cubs held up so well last year, we expect to see a little regression. I do expect them to get in the playoffs, though. And, you know, it'll be the old boring story of the Cubs always winning the World Series, perhaps.
So in the National League, they might be the biggest threat. Just name a team that will be a bigger or a threat to them?
I think the Dodgers will be better than the Cubs. Las Vegas disagrees. I've had my disputes with that city over the years. But just in terms of talent and Clayton Kershaw, the best pitcher in baseball, they could in the regular season win more games. And then again, we'll see what happens in the playoffs.
Okay. So, by the way, the American League, a long way from October. Is Cleveland the favorite?
Cleveland's good. People don't think that they can say that the Houston Astros are the favorite because they've been so terrible for so long, but some advanced metrics are telling us that the Astros could do it if, have I mentioned this, if their arms stay healthy. That seems to be important in baseball.
Yeah. Look, Major League Baseball wants to speed up the pace of play almost more than we speed up these segments to try to get everything in. The average length of a game is just over 3 hours. How do you do that, speed it up?
I think I don't think it's that difficult. I think it's umpires telling batters when they step out of the box to adjust their gloves or to do nothing. You have to get back in here. And so I think it's just a matter of umpires umpiring and saying you've got to get in and not step out and not giving guys time out. It's that time between pitches where nothing happens. I don't even mind a pitcher looking a runner over or throwing to first or things like that. It's no one on base. Batter steps out. Oh, the gloves have to be adjusted. You didn't even swing.
Yeah. But that's a part of the thing. They adjust everything, as you know. And that's a ritual. I mean, you're messing with Major League players' rituals.
If you go back to the – is it a ritual or OCD? You know, like ritual has a pejorative also. If you go back – I'm not talking about the era of Mordecai Three Finger Brown. I'm talking about if you go back to the 90s, it just wasn't done. It wasn't done at the rate it's done now. And you could shave 20 minutes off a game with enforcement of that.
Okay. Real quick, the hockey playoffs start next week. NHL says its players will not play in the Winter Olympics next year in South Korea. Quick thought.
The Russians aren't going to send their players either. It's another blow to the Winter Olympics. I think that brand of the Olympics is really hurting. Only two cities even want to host the Olympics.
Yeah. Well, take that up at another time. Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst. He also hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Check it out. Mike, stop adjusting everything. It's radio.
I want my arm to stay healthy.
It's Here and Now. As we noted earlier, Devin Nunes, chair of the House Intelligence Committee, announced today that he's temporarily stepping aside from the investigation into Russian election interference and possible Trump campaign collusion. Nunes, a Trump transition team member, has been accused of compromising the investigation by going to the White House grounds to review secret evidence we now know was provided to him by White House staffers, and then taking what he saw to the president, adding fodder to Trump's claim that he'd been wiretapped, even though the evidence did not show that. And just yesterday, the president told the New York Times that the Russia story is a hoax. There has been absolutely nothing coming out of that. Well, our next guest is a Trump critic, but is warning Trump's other detractors not to get too worked up about all this. Masha Gessen is a Russian-born New Yorker who's made a name for herself as a critic of both Trump and, before that, Russian President Putin. She wrote the 2012 Putin biography, The Man Without a Face. A year later, she left Russia when officials began talking about taking adopted children away from gay or lesbian parents such as herself. She's a contributing opinion writer for The New York Times. Her next book is titled The Future is History: How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. Masha, welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Given that you aren't a fan of either Putin or Trump, you say that one of your concerns about what's happening now in America is that Trump's critics in particular may be going down some sort of paranoid rabbit hole in things like the investigation of Russian ties to the election. That might surprise people who might think that's the first thing you'd want Americans to figure out because you're no fan of Putin. Explain that.
Well, first of all, I think that reality is probably much messier than what we imagine. And what we imagine every time we engage in conspiracy thinking is something neat and simple that solves all of our problems, problems of the imagination and also problems of our life, right? And and the thing about this conspiracy theory about the Russian interference in the election is that the way we imagine it, right, it solves both the past, which is how we got Trump, and the future, which is how we get rid of Trump.
Because there'll be impeachment, surely, if there was collusion. I mean, let's be clear. There are two separate things here. U.S. intelligence officers are pretty much are concluding that there was Russian interference, whether or not it had anything to do with the outcome, no one has said. And the question is whether there's been collusion. You're saying these are all the wrong questions because it makes us feel as if we answer them, then it's all over.
Exactly. And in fact, you know, even if we find out that there was an actual measurable impact on the outcome of the election, which is virtually impossible to prove, right? Yeah. Even if we find out that there was active collusion between the campaign and Russia, which is extremely unlikely to be established definitively, even that is not going to take care of the simple problem that Americans elected Trump. Right. I mean, the current intelligence theory as to how Russia ultimately influenced the outcome of the election was that Russia did it through open sources, through using RT, the television network, and other media as propaganda tools. That may be disgusting, but it's not illegal.
Well, and this is part of what you say when you say open, that Americans might be too busy looking at the secretive, when in fact, right in front of their faces are things right out in the open that they should be looking at. Like what?
That, I think, is the key problem, is that Trump poses an actual threat to politics as it is constituted in the United States. He actually poses a threat to our ability to act meaningfully in the political space. To give you an example, you know, there was a moment last week when Senate hearings on the Trump's Supreme Court nominee were like the number 4 or 5 news story of the day. Mm. That's not normal, right? And that is actual sort of measurable damage to public politics.
Well, you talk about right out in the open as a Secretary of State who came to his job with no relevant experience. Now helms the decimated State Department because of the cuts there. So you're saying, you know, focus on that. Look, and as we have said repeatedly, Trump voters are say on the completely other side. They're saying this man was elected and now he's being prevented from doing his job because of investigations and being stymied with some of his appointments. You know, we know how that debate unfolds here. But let's get to some of the other things that concern you. You also talk about how what used to be considered impossible is so quickly becoming normal.
Right. I think that's actually one of the reasons that we're engaging in conspiracy thinking, because I think conspiracy thinking happens when the unimaginable happens. And so we'll look for a reasonable explanation for facing the unimaginable. You know, it wasn't imaginable just a few months ago that that Trump would build the wall. I remember shortly after the election, people were debating how seriously we should be taking his claims, which is a valid question, right? This is a man who lies all the time. So how do we actually figure out what to listen to and what to listen for?
And I just want to jump in to say that at NPR, we are not categorizing the president's words as lies, because the definition of the very definition of lies is intent. Somebody intended to tell an untruth, and we don't know what's going on in his head and whether or not he's being fed false information when he falsely says, for instance, that people boarded buses and went to New Hampshire to vote. So we are not categorizing them as lies, but they're certainly not
true. Am I allowed to?
Yes, you are. They're okay. Certainly not true. But your point is that it sort of snowballed and suddenly we're looking at mock-ups of the wall.
Exactly. And that's almost not news anymore, right? I mean, you actually have to do some Googling in order to find out what's going on with the wall. It's not on the front pages.
Are you looking at this from a uniquely Russian point of view? This idea of something being unimaginable and then, oh, there you are.
I don't think I'm looking at it from a uniquely Russian point of view, but I do think that my Russian experience has been peculiarly useful in trying to wrap my mind around what's happening here, partly because I've spent much of my professional life thinking about issues of autocracy and collaboration and moral choice, but also about imagination. Because one of the reasons I've been so obsessed with the issue of imagination is because I've thought and written a lot about how people have handled something in history that is unimaginable, which is Stalin's terror, right? And how that seems to always lend itself to both conspiracy thinking and sense-making and, weirdly, exaggeration, right? Because once you have sort of acknowledged something once, it stops being unimaginable. And so in order to convey the unimaginable quality, you have to resort to hyperbole. You can't just stop at saying, this is unimaginable and shocking, and I can't make sense of it.
You have a caution for people on the left in America that while they're so critical of what they saw as fake news coming from the extreme right, that they're doing it themselves. You offer an example of, you know, conspiracy theories that were floating around, all the Russians who've recently died, and these theories linked them to the investigation of Russia in the elections. What would you say to the left about why that's happening and what they should know?
Well, it's classic conspiracy thinking in the sense that it's not entirely baseless, but people who know very little about Russia have jumped on the bandwagon and tied together deaths that are not at all related to anything.
Yeah. What do you make of the stories of people, some with direct ties to Donald Trump, like now ex-advisor Carter Page, Eric Prince from Blackwater, meeting with Russians, these reports that are surfacing? I mean, as you watch this as a Russian, do you think they're being played by Putin?
Well, first of all, as someone who's covered Russia for a quarter century, I'm not surprised. The Russian modus operandi, and before it, the Soviet modus operandi, was to cast a wide recruiting net to try to go after people whose ambitions exceeded their abilities, to try to go after people who are greedy, to try to capture outliers. It so happens that Trump's campaign was almost by accident constituted in a similar principle. Right? Trump's campaign sort of drew outliers from the from political circles. Even someone like Jeff Sessions, who's probably one of the most establishment people in the campaign, was, for a senator, an outlier. So there's a confluence here. For that reason, you know, I don't think that an investigation into possible links of the campaign to Russia is baseless. The investigation should be happening. We just shouldn't be obsessed with it, and we shouldn't be pinning all our hopes on it.
Masha Gessen, author of the Putin biography, The Man Without a Face. She's also a contributing opinion writer for The New York Times. Her latest piece, The Truth is Not a Toy. Masha, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
The list of advertisers moving away from the O'Reilly factor continues to grow. More than 45 companies have now pulled ads from the Fox News show after the New York Times published a story over the weekend that revealed Fox had settled 5 sexual harassment lawsuits related to Bill O'Reilly. The settlements totaled more than $13 million. Joining us now is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
And first of all, remind us about these allegations. What are these women saying happened and when?
Well, there's a series of allegations going back to more than a dozen years. Each of them indicate that O'Reilly talked about his influence and his ability to get people hired, that he could make things happen for them. You know, getting a guest spot on his show can be something that is, you know, it starts out unpaid. If you get to be a Fox News contributor on that show, it's the most watched show in cable news. It can be a pretty lucrative thing, and it can be a springboard to get more money to in speaking engagements outside Fox, in possible book deals, and other kinds of ways in which one packages and merchandises oneself as a pundit. And those are things women, you know, and men equally want. Well, O'Reilly seemed to use that, according to these allegations, a bit as a way of a dating pool and encouraging women to do that in exchange for, in a sense, entering romantic or physical engagements with him. I think it's important for us to say O'Reilly says these accusations only come because he's such a prominent man, such a successful and wealthy man, and the only reason he's settled and Fox News has settled is because he wanted to save his children from public scorn. But, you know, to pay millions of dollars, as he did about $9 million to one of his former producers who caught him on tape making extremely sexual explicit advances, and other women who whom he apparently or allegedly made approaches to over the years were paid some millions of dollars as well. This is a, you know, this is a suggestion of a strong pattern of behavior and one that's not dissimilar to what we've heard at Fox News.
And whatever actually happened, obviously this has made a lot of advertisers uncomfortable. I want to read a few statements from some of these companies that have pulled advertising. This is from Mercedes-Benz. Quote, the allegations are disturbing, and given the importance of women in every aspect of our business, we don't feel this is a good environment in which to advertise our products right now. And then the pharmaceutical company Bayer says Bayer supports a safe, respectful, and non-abusive environment for women, and we have reached out to Fox to voice our concerns regarding this matter. Based on the serious nature of these allegations, we have made the decision to suspend all advertising on the program in question. David, will these advertisers leaving actually affect the show's bottom line, because he's got a lot more advertisers than the ones that we've mentioned here. And also, I read that some of the advertisers have just decided to put their money into other Fox News shows.
Most of the advertisers appear to be pulling their ads from O'Reilly rather than Fox News itself. And that means Fox can, at least for a time, ride this out. You know, advertisers, on the other hand, are paying a premium, most by and large, to be on the O'Reilly factor. And so you have to give them, in a sense, makeup spots or additional time or charge them reduced rates or take care of them in some way if they're not going to be aired during that top-rated program. In addition, it's worth watching who stays on the O'Reilly show. You know, when this happened to Glenn Beck and the pressure really mounted, ultimately, the number of advertisers pulling their ads from the show did make a dent in Beck's popularity and ultimately helped to ease his way to the door when Roger Ailes, then the chairman, had had enough. But right now, it's worth watching who's advertising on O'Reilly. I think that they are, from the account of folks watching it closely, they're diminishing quite how many ads they run per hour. And some of the folks advertising are not perhaps quite the same level of prestige as a BMW, as a top flight pharmaceutical. Jenny Craig, you know, the diet center that you know, has this clientele significantly female, took a long time to say, you know, they were going to pull their ads from the show as well. One advertiser that pulled its ads from not just from O'Reilly but from Fox News itself was the leading trade group for the HR industry. That is, folks who might acknowledge that if there were questions not only about whether he had sexually harassed colleagues but had been, in a sense, allowed to do so by the top lawyers and top executives at the network for some years with quiet payment outs to keep it secluded from the public, they might say this is a problem for us to be associated with.
Okay. Well, let's listen to one more thing here, because this is what President Trump said to the New York Times about this in an interview. Let's listen.
I think he's a person I know well. He's a good person. I think he may, you know, I think he shouldn't have settled.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I think he shouldn't have settled.
How come?
Because you should have taken it all the way. No, I know Bill. Bill's a good person.
Why would President Trump weigh in on this?
Well, there are a couple things going on. First of all, he has re-entered a bromance with Fox News generally since the election, and they've sort of held each other close in a way that during much of the primary season he did not. Secondly, Bill O'Reilly came out swinging for him. When the Access Hollywood tapes come out, you could hear Trump boasting of having sexually assaulted a woman a decade ago. O'Reilly said, no, he's only being attacked because he's successful. And they kind of are in the same group. These are prominent men who seem to embrace bombast and anger as part of their rhetoric. They're simpatico on much of their policies, and they're both under attack from women who say that what they've done is reprehensible. These guys are clan to each other. This is a support group that you're seeing in the Oval Office right there.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, and you can leave your comments at hereandnow.org. David, thank you.
You bet.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.